Okay, I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. We'll start by having the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katuza Watoon, Vice
Chair.
Representative Franson. Representative Bonner. Representative Damuth.
Present.
Representative Heintzman. Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Pryor. Representative Wasilek.
Present.
Representative West.
Okay, we have a quorum. If I could have a motion to approve our minutes, the minutes of our meeting on March 5th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman moves approval of the March 5th minutes. Any discussion? All in favor of approval of those minutes, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Thank you. We have minutes approved. So, members, we've got four bills on the agenda this morning. The first one is House File 1382. We'll have Representative Richardson come up. This bill received a hearing last year. You'll see some names on your on the agenda available for questions if there are any. But otherwise, it was heard and was included, I think, in our committee budget and did end up passing the House floor. Representative Richardson, is there an amended, I think you may have an amendment that makes the language match what did pass the House floor. If I can have a motion to move the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the form the author wishes.
So moved.
All right, Representative Wasilek moves the DE1 amendment. Katuza Watoon did. Oh, pardon me. Misheard that. Representative Katuza Watoon moves the DE1 amendment. And again, my understanding is that this puts it in the form that it passed the House and is the author's wishes. Any discussion? All in favor of approval of the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the bill is in the form the author wishes. Can you just remind us, Representative Richardson, about 1382 as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1382 is a bill that fixes a problem that deaf advocates and Metro Deaf School believed was addressed during the 2015 session. In 2015, legislation was passed that allowed Metro Deaf School, a special education charter school for children who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing, to accept preschool children through parent choice. There was strong bipartisan support for the bill. Metro Deaf School is the only school in the metro area that provides preschool instruction in American Sign Language. The school believed the legislation covered all preschool children, but learned that it did not include children ages 0 to 3. It's critically important for preschoolers who are deaf to be placed in language-rich environments during early childhood. Only about 10% of babies that are deaf are born to parents who are deaf. 90% are born to hearing parents, the majority of which do not know American Sign Language. Early access to language is essential to support children in meeting developmental milestones. The period of birth to 2 is especially critical in terms of acquisition of language and cognition for all children. This bill gives families the potential to provide their children with the same quality of early life experience as their hearing peers in early childhood by expanding eligibility to age birth to 3 for students that are deaf, hard of hearing, or deafblind.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Representative Richardson or about the bill? Many members. And so hearing none, Representative Katuza Watoon, no, I'm trying to think of whose motion it was originally. It was Katuza Watoon, thank you. The plan is to have this bill be re-referred to the Education Finance Division. And so Representative Katuza Watoon, will you renew your motion that House File 1382, as amended, be re-referred to Education Finance?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion? And then hearing none, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Your bill is on its way to Education Finance. And thank you so much, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, next, members, we have House File 3693. So, Representative Mann, you are up. And then once you're, if we can have, if I can have a motion to move House File 3693.
So moved.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. And this is for it to be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Division. Is that correct, Representative Bonner?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And then there's a DE1 amendment to House File 3693. We'll have Representative Bonner make that motion as well. Any discussion regarding the DE1 amendment? This will put the bill in the form the author wishes. So hearing none, all in favor of the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. So House File 3693 is in the form you wish. Representative Mann, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 3693 is a bill that will allow counties or tribes to apply for a competitive grant on an effort to expand inclusive child care settings for children with disabilities. We all know, as you guys especially know, that we have a child care shortage in Minnesota, and that includes a shortage in child care centers and child care providers who care for children with disabilities and specific needs. We have families where we've had a parent who's had to drop out of the workforce in order to stay home to take care of their child because that child has been removed from child care settings because child care settings cannot meet their needs. And so the goal here is to give families more choices as far as child care goes, and in doing so, by doing it in an inclusive setting. And by doing that, we're going to have kids who can go to daycare with their siblings. We'll have kids who will be around their peers, learning important social interactions and social skills. It'll be a place where they can see other kids like them, and parents will be able to go back to work. With that, I would like to introduce my testifiers.
Please, yes, please identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Maren Halden. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I'm here in my professional capacity. I've represented children with disabilities for several years at the Disability Law Center. But I'm also here in my personal capacity as a parent. A few years after I started at the Disability Law Center, my son August was born. And when he was two, we found out that he has cerebral palsy, which is a super helpful explanation of why it's really hard for him to move his muscles in the ways that he wants. He's now three, and he just started walking about a month and a half ago, and he's working really hard at talking, but he mostly still uses a lot of signs to communicate. So we started August at a child care center, the closest one to our house, when he was about 6 months old, and he's gone there ever since. And now his one-year-old brother goes there too. And it's been a great place for him. They've found ways to accommodate him really well, even though he hasn't developed like most of the other kids at the center. There's a spot in his classroom for his walker. The teachers really work to communicate with him. One of the teachers actually went to the library next door and took out an ASL book from the library to learn sign language to be able to communicate with him better. And being part of that environment and those classes has been tremendous for August. We don't really know, and I don't, you know, it can vary with the cerebral palsy diagnosis, how he's impacted cognitively, but he is learning the things that typical three-year-olds learn. This past weekend at conferences, his teacher told us that he's mastered the classroom routines. He rolls up his Montessori rug, sometimes even better and more carefully than other kids. He's obsessed with colors and shapes and knows all the signs for all of them. And he even started to be able to make the right mouth sounds when we showed him certain individual letters, which has been really exciting for us. But more importantly, he's experienced belonging and being part of a community. One of his teachers told me a story that they sing this song in their circle where they call each kid's name and that kid has to jump up. And August can't jump. But they've taught him that when it's his turn, that he should rise to a stand, which he was only able to do on his own recently. And so the first time they did that, all of the kids cheered. August is learning to walk at school, and every time he takes steps, the kids cheer him on. And he feels so loved there. But the other part that surprised me a lot is how much I've heard from other parents about how being at school with August benefits their kids. Like, a dad literally once stopped me at Target to say how grateful he was that his three boys get to go to school with August, because August shows his boys how wide a range of normal can be. I'm so grateful for the experience that my son is having at childcare and with his brother too, but I know from my professional capacity that this is not the experience that many families of children with disabilities have. At the Disability Law Center, I handled cases all the time where children were either being asked to leave childcare provider settings because of their disability or were not let into them in the first place. Because the provider was unable to meet their needs. And in some cases, I felt like the provider could have probably done a little bit more to accommodate the child. But many times, children really do present significant needs that are beyond the capacity of what child care providers are able to do. This proposal would allow childcare providers and counties to work together to figure out both what are the supports that childcare providers need in order to serve children with significant medical needs or disabilities, and what is the best way to get those supports to them. Maybe that looks like children sharing a PCA on site. Maybe that looks like three kids clustering at one childcare provider setting and that childcare provider being able to staff up one full-time person. Maybe that means a cluster of kids sharing a home care nurse at one childcare provider site. And for any of those, a childcare provider may need environmental changes, they may need administrative help with licensing, they may need some teacher training or time for their teachers to be trained. So I'm really grateful for your time this morning and hearing this important bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And to the other testifier, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Maren Christensen-Hofer, the other Maren, and I'm the parent of an autistic child, and unfortunately my story is not quite as happy ending as Maren Holden's. I'm here to talk to you today about the question of child care for disabilities. And we knew when we were looking for child care before my son was diagnosed with autism that he had some difficulties. He had some challenges in relation to typically developing kids. We knew that he had a very heightened fight or flight response, and he had some challenges with sensory processing issue. He does best in environments that are calm and quiet, which, as you can imagine, are really difficult to find in daycare or preschool settings. So we were overjoyed when we found a small center that seemed to be a good fit for him. He began attending that child care provider, and that worked well. When he was about three, he received a diagnosis of autism. And on the very day that we told the center, we disclosed his diagnosis to them, they told us that they could no longer meet his needs. And that wasn't based on any particular action or event that happened. It was really based just on the diagnosis alone. And the stigma around the word autism is so strong that they just said, nope, that's not something we're prepared to handle. We looked for other options for him, but were unsuccessful. And it ended up that I was unable to continue a 20-year career in international business development for a medical device company. It was clear that there just weren't any options that were going to work for our family. As Maren mentioned, you know, it's clear that there are some children that require more support than others, and that does cost money. Lower child care to provider ratios cost money. Accessible buildings cost money. Staff training costs money. There's no denying that, but it is very clear that it costs significantly less to support those child care providers and provide that assistance than it does to have parents drop out of the workforce because they can't find inclusive child care. There was an analysis of the National Survey of Children's Health data that showed compared to parents of non-disabled children, parents of young children with disabilities are three times more likely to drop out of the workforce. And I know that there are many other families like ours. This bill would take a step towards addressing that problem, and it would also go a long way to promoting inclusion, which is so important for our kids. We know that inclusion helps kids with disabilities prepare for school and produces better outcomes for them. We know, as Maren stated, that true inclusion is good for the typically developing children as well because they learn the value of their disabled peers and the value of people of all abilities. We know that inclusion leads to friendships and belonging. It leads to kids with disabilities seeing themselves in a positive light. And it creates an environment for communicating about disability. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's not something to hide. It's making the statement that we'll be building communities where everybody has a place. And I think it's really important to point out that inclusion is not about simply putting a body in a room and taking up the same space. Inclusion is about intentional planning for all students to succeed in that environment. And we're asking you to take the step of supporting this bill to help us get a little bit closer to that true inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a question from Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question. I just want to say that I'm really excited about this legislation and this grant funding. I work in a child care program in a school, and it's been a struggle even for our program with all the resources that we have and all the staff we have to meet the needs of kids with disabilities. So I'm really excited to see this happening, and I'm really looking forward to what we're seeing out of the program, but also out of the reporting to find out how we can help even more. So thank you.
Thank you. I have a clarification question. I see it looks like the grant recipients would be counties or tribes, and then they would then award grants to a number of child care providers as described in the bill. Am I understanding that structure right? It looks like Representative Mann may be answering.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Other questions the members have? Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mann, thank you for bringing this forward. And Marin and Marin, is that correct?
Both Marin.
Thanks for your testimony. Representative Mann, if we look on line 319 of the DE1.
Which line? I'm sorry.
3.19. It talks about the availability and use of funding sources other than through the grant program. I'm just wondering, does that include any early childhood special education services provided by the child's resident school district?
Representative Mann or maybe Ms. Holden? Or
sure. Representative Damuth and Chair Pinto. I think it potentially could, but I don't know that it would. If the point of listing other ways in which the grant recipients should point out what they're doing is to find out what collection of funding streams gets a child to the supports that they need in order to be successful in a child care setting. Some school districts do provide early childhood special education through pushed-in supports to community child care centers. Other school districts do not do it that way, and they run their ECSC out of their own district buildings. And so I could imagine that depending on the circumstance, that a child who's in a community child care setting in a district where ECSC supports are pushed into that child care center, then that child might benefit from those supports and might need the benefits of a grant like this a little bit less than a kid who's in an after-hours child care program outside of the maybe 2.5 hours a day they do at their district-sponsored ECSE program would need in their community child care setting where they're not accessing school district personnel. I don't think it would necessarily change the actual disbursement of funds, but it might change how much of this type of program that child would need. Does that answer make sense?
Representative Damon.
Thank you. Thank you, okay. Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill talks quite a bit about data that's being collected, and I'm going to focus on 2.3 to start with in the DE. And I'd like to have a better idea what data we're collecting and then also what precautions we're taking to protect that data, especially in the area of this particular bill's focus. I think it'd be very important that we spell that out before we start moving it on.
Ms. Holden or Representative Mann or... See who wants to take that.
Chair, Ms. Representative Heintzman, I can speak to the data collection, what data collecting. I think that in order to make best use of learning from the pilot, it would be important to collect information around how many children are served, in what type of setting, what types of needs above and beyond a typical child those children presented, and what measures were taken and kind of how much they cost and how they were funded in order to meet those needs. I am not a data practices expert. My understanding would be that if the department is collecting that data, it would be subject to Chapter 13, the way that most of our data is governed. But I also don't think that this language requires necessarily that it be individualized data on the child and more data about the types of needs that the children being served were presenting and the methods that were used to meet those needs.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Representative Mann, you could confirm that for us and get that information. Because I'd like to know who's getting the data and if it is under Chapter 13. And then also, I'm wondering if this bill, Mr. Chair, is going to be reviewed by Judiciary and Civil Law regarding the data portions of this. As you know, this is a sensitive subject for a lot of people, so
I'm trying to
voice that concern for them.
Thank you. I'll maybe see if Representative Mann has checked in on that, though I'll maybe make a comment just before I do that it looks like the grants are going to go to two recipients, two counties, that then would go out to several providers who would have a couple of children. I mean, it's relatively small scale. I'm sort of thinking about I did training for police officers on human trafficking through a state grant, and we had to report back on the outcomes. But of course, it was, you know, things like this is the number of officers trained, this is the evaluations, et cetera. And so I guess I'm assuming there'd be similar, as opposed to sort of data about individual children. It's more sort of these are the results being achieved. But Representative Mann, thoughts about this going to judiciary? I'm not sure if you've checked in with them or have any thoughts about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, as far as I know, it does not go to judiciary simply because it's not individualized data. But
it would be worth confirming that, of course,
absolutely,
as it moves on. And Representative Damuth, yeah, or Representative Heisman, not sure if you're done. Okay. Representative Damuth, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
One more question, Representative Mann. On line 2.9, starting on 2.8, it talks about providing back a report to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over health and human services on the outcomes. Have you considered adding, because of that connection between early childhood and childcare, have you considered adding those committees with jurisdiction over early childhood to the reporting back?
Okay, Representative Damuth, there you go. Exactly, Representative
Mann.
Thank you, Representative Damuth, good point.
We have not, but I think I have no issues with that whatsoever.
Well done, Representative Damuth, that's right. so perhaps, I don't know that that feels substantive enough that I don't want to necessarily do as an oral amendment, but perhaps you can look for that in the next committee to make sure that gets included. Representative Katiza, what are you doing?
Mr. Chair, being that we are a subdivision of the Health and Human Services overarching umbrella, would that include us?
And Representative Katiza, it might, but I really like the idea, Representative Damuth, of making sure to call us out as well. So let's make sure to keep an eye on that. Great. As it goes through the process.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify on the bill? I should have asked that before. I'm not seeing anyone. And then any further member questions or comments about the bill? Representative Mann will give you the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, this is just, a bill to try to be innovative and to try to expand access to care, especially with families who are really struggling to find that care right now. So I thank you for your questions and for your support.
Okay, good. Thank you. So with that, Representative Bonner renews her motion that House File 3693, as amended, be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance Division. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. So with that, the bill is moving to HHS Finance, hopefully with the Damuth edition. We'll work on that. Thank you so much. So Representative Morrison, we're going to have you go up for House File 3504. And as you do, Representative Morrison will be moving the moving House File 3504, moving that it be placed on the General Register, and we'll discuss that a little bit. That'll be in connection with the amendment that'll be coming up. But Representative Morrison, why don't you introduce the bill if you can, and then we'll move to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 3504, which is a bill to limit individual use screens in publicly funded preschool and kindergartens, and to create an educational public service campaign to educate parents on the effects of screen use by children. This would be consistent with the American Academy of Pediatrics screen time recommendations of no screens before 18 months and a maximum of 1 hour per day for 2 to 5 year olds with adult involvement. And with that, I will turn it over to these two incredible advocates for this issue, Lisa Venable and Judy Stoffel, to further explain the need for this bill.
And Representative Morris, was it your preference to do that before we do the amendment?
I was hoping that I could, Mr. Chair, with your approval, to move the amendment at the conclusion of their testimony.
Okay, we can do it that way. Yeah. So then, who will be going first? Whoever will be going first, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you.
Okay, identify yourself for the record and please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Morrison and Chairman. My name is Judy Stoffel, and I'm from Chanhassen, Minnesota. I'm happy to be here today to talk to you about what I really feel is the largest parenting issue of our generation, which is screen time. I'm a CPA, author, mother, and researcher. As a parent of five children, ranging in age from 16 to 30, I've seen firsthand how technology has changed, both in and out of the classroom. So where do I personally stand on technology? I'm not anti-tech. I think the genie's out of the bottle. I have a cell phone. My children have devices. But I do think that there's a big difference between a young child using these devices and an adult using the screens. Representative Morris told you a little bit about our bill, and I'd like to start with a little bit of background information. So the American Academy of Pediatrics recently introduced a new policy statement, which she alluded to. The guidelines are saying no screens for children under 18 months, except for video chatting with, say, traveling parents or grandparents. And also for children ages 2 to 5, they're recommending no screen time unless it's co-viewed with an adult, so an adult can sit there and tell them how it translates into the real world. So how do these AAP guidelines compare with how much kids are actually using their screens today? Common Sense Media in December of 2019 just completed a very large study on how kids are using screens, and they found that 8 to 12-year-olds are spending 5 hours a day in front of a screen, and that doesn't even include at school or doing homework. Teens are even worse at 7 hours a day, 7.5. So I'm a CPA, and I always like to, you know, run the numbers, crunch the numbers. And to me, the math doesn't really add up, because if teens are on their screen 7.5 hours a day, and then we know a lot of them are using Chromebooks at school, that's another 7 to 8 hours a day, and they're supposed to be sleeping around 8 hours a day, they still have to allow time for transportation, doing their homework, extracurricular activities, showering, things like that. Well, that's over 24 hours. So I really looked into this study with Common Sense Media, and the numbers actually are true because kids are double-dipping. They're texting while they're streaming or eating while they're playing video games, etc. But from what I can tell, if they're on their phone 7.5 hours for entertainment, and if they have Chromebooks or iPad at school, they're basically on some kind of a screen almost 100% of their waking hours. And that's a trend that we're trying to change.
And I just want to alert members that the slides were stapled, looks like, in reverse order. So just in case you're following along the presentation, it goes from backwards to front. So no problem. Please continue.
Okay.
That's no problem.
So what about specifically about Minnesota's schools? Star Tribune just did a very large investigation on how screens are being used in Minnesota. And they looked at the 25 largest school districts and found that 17 of them have a one-to-one device ratio in their school, which is about 70% of children using screens. In St. Paul, preschoolers have their own iPad. In Eden Prairie, kindergartners all have their own iPad. Today's tech is really designed to addict us. Silicon Valley is hiring the engineers from Las Vegas that designed the slot machine, and they're putting the same addictive technology into our devices to get us addicted, largely for their bottom line profit. For example, 97% of all of the tech companies' revenue comes from advertising. When you want to open a Gmail account, it's free. If you want to search on Google, it's free. Open up a Facebook account, it's free. So if everything we do is free, how are these few companies worth $1.5 trillion? It's because we are the product. And rules of engagement is their bread and butter. What was even more infuriating to me when I was doing my research was that Silicon Valley engineers don't even let their own children use devices until around age 14, including Steve Jobs, the late Steve Jobs, and Bill Gates. They're also sending their kids to screen-free schools. You see, the iPad and the Chromebook wasn't invented until around 2010, 2011. So schools started rolling them out in Minnesota starting after 2012. They weren't really tested to make sure that this was a better learning tool than the alternative, which is a textbook, handwritten note, and teachers. But now the data is starting to roll out, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the recent studies that are coming. So in December 2019, there's been a lot of specials on television relating to screen time. Diane Sawyer did an ABC special on 2020. Anderson Cooper did a special called Brain Hacking. And they announced that the National Institute of Health has now approved $300 million to study screens, children using screens. They're starting with 9 and 10-year-olds, and they're going to test 11,000 children for a decade and see what happens to their brain and their physical health. Normally, they would not put any of the results out because this is a 10-year study. But they've already given us information because parents need to understand. They did MRIs on the first 4,500 children and compared their actual brains with how much screen time they're using. And they found that at 2 hours a day, there's cognitive decline when children are using screens. For younger children, the data is even daunting. For the 3 and 5-year-olds, JAMA Pediatrics just reported that 1 hour a day results in cognitive decline for young children, such as not being able to remember, say, the name for a ball. It's getting harder and harder, actually, to study screens on children because it's getting hard to find a control group because you need a group of children who are willing to give up their devices, right? So why are we here? Why would we start with the state government? I believe we need to meet this attention economy with enormous vigor to save our growing children from the negative effects. It's going to take a concerted effort by parents, communities, schools, government, and of course Silicon Valley. We have all of these protections in the physical world, such as crime, we have the police force, Food and Drug Administration, the FTC, the National Transportation Board. But we don't have that alternative in the digital world. All of this technology just went too fast. It's time we play catch up, and I think we need to start with our youngest children. I want to see the state of Minnesota leading the country by having a conversation and legislation about when and how technology can serve children in Minnesota schools. Thank you, Chairman, for your time.
Thank you so much. And so to our other testifier, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Lisa Venable, and I live in Minnetonka. I come to this issue as a grandmother, psychotherapist, and an early childhood consultant. I've advocated for children all my life, first as a lobbyist with United Way, and second as a consultant to this very legislature as facilitator of the Early Childhood Caucus. The consequences of the digital age became apparent to me years ago when I started watching the younger generation glued to their cell phones, as if in a trance. You've all seen them out for a meal together, not talking to each other, but staring into a device. Are our children more captivated by screens than by life itself? Are they being less playful, interactive, and imaginative? Are they becoming so distracted by these devices that it's affecting their learning? I started to talk to parents and teachers and found I was not the only one concerned. And when I looked at the research and I heard that Silicon Valley executives send their kids to screen-free schools, I thought it's time to speak up. It's time, as Judy said, to start the conversation. And I knew we had to begin with the littlest learners. Because 90% of a child's brain develops in the first 5 years, we need to start early and ensure they're having developmentally appropriate experiences. You know, overstimulation tires the brains. When you think about these devices close to their little faces, the fast-paced shows, the games, all the swiping, Their brains become sluggish and tired and hard to stay focused. Some of you might notice that yourself when you're, you know, we're all doing this with our phones and our iPads and our devices. And I learned as I did this, as I studied and I talked to Judy, and I read Judy has an amazing book about all the research and all the consequences. Things like lower attention spans, memory skill, difficulty listening, difficulty completing tasks. They're having poor sleep habits. And in our teens, it's creating a higher amounts of depression and anxiety and suicide. And they can see when the iPhone came out and the correlation to this for our teenagers. And then research is coming out, as Judy said, another piece of research that we just found that just came out a couple months ago about screens changing the white matter in a child's brain. So little kids who reported more screen time showed lower levels of development in that white matter where cognition, literacy, and language skills are developing. This is hugely concerning. The biggest thing we need to look at is what does screen time replace for young children? In this committee, I'm sure you've heard how young children best learn. They learn through play. They learn through sensory learning, reading or talking from a parent or an adult, storytelling, singing, and eye contact, especially with babies and toddlers. When a mom is breastfeeding and doing this the whole time she's breastfeeding, she's not making eye contact with her child. When a toddler is saying, "Mommy, Mommy," or "Daddy, look at me, look at what I'm doing," and the parent is over here because, as Judy said, they're addicting. We all know that it's an addicting kind of device. And so it's hard to connect with your children when we're on the phones. We know in early childhood that one-to-one relationships with adults are the most critical thing for early childhood brain development. And overuse of screens is taking children away from that, and adults as well. It's also taking away from exercise and whole body movement. When a baby is learning and they're grabbing for something, using their bodies is so important for their learning and cognitive development. They're not being outside as much. You can even see toy stores are closing. Kids aren't playing as much with toys. They're looking at YouTube videos. We really feel that it's time to have a public awareness campaign and do public service announcements. We need to start educating, especially parents of young children, about overuse of digital devices and how it affects brain development. It's not just television. This is very different than television when we all grew up. Many of us probably watched TV when we were kids. This is about a device that goes with us everywhere, a device that's held really close to our face and that is constant. You know, it almost never goes away. What experiences screens take away from and how young children learn best, we need to help parents understand that. And again, how parents' own screen use is affecting a baby or a child. A lot of parents aren't aware of that, and we want to educate them about the research that is out there. The other thing we want to do is limit the use of iPads for young children in preschools and kindergarten. As both Judy and Representative Morrison mentioned, the American Academy of Pediatric Guidelines, we want to be in compliance with those. They're saying an hour a day minimum. Now, if kids are on iPads all day at school, it's actually harder to get them not to use them at night. So that hour limit is going to get exceeded. And preschool-aged children need developmentally appropriate experiences for learning. They don't need an iPad. Even Steve Jobs, the Apple CEO, said they were not intended for children. And he didn't give his until they were, as Judy said, 14 years old. And I'm hearing from preschool teachers that they feel they're being forced to use these iPads because the district spent all this money on them. But nobody's asked them if it's a better way for a child to learn. There's no proof of that. So now is the time for us to take action. We can't wait for more studies. Every month that we wait, a child's brain grows. And how is it growing and how is it being affected? So let's be the leader in this country and get the dialogue going. You can make a big impact on this issue today, and we ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Venable. I'll first find out if there's anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill in the audience. And I'm not seeing anyone. Member questions. Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really appreciate the testimony, Representative Morris, from your group here today. I'm hearing a couple of different things, and I'm wondering, because in my own house, we're definitely very keyed in on this issue. We have six kids, so I understand five.
Okay, yeah.
And screen time is a big struggle. For us, it's not as difficult maybe because we're homeschoolers and we don't have some of the challenges that were described in testimony relative to, okay, you have Chromebooks that are being distributed amongst huge blocks of kids at school. How effective is my question here? How effective could this effort be when we're kind of, as a state of Minnesota or as education in general, sending a bit of a different message? On one hand, we're saying, okay, we're going to distribute these screens to lots and lots and lots of kids, but then we're going to try to do a public awareness campaign that says that might be bad.
Is whoever wants to answer that. Representative Morrison, perhaps?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start, and my testifiers may want to comment as well. Thank you for the question, Representative Heinzman. First of all, I commend you because I think many people would say it would be a lot easier if you homeschooled to use screens a lot because they make parenting easier in a lot of ways, which is one of the challenges. But I think part of the point of the bill is to change our practices in the state of Minnesota and to get away from using screens in our schools for young kids.
Yeah, I guess I would. What I would say, Mr. Chairman, what I would say is that this all happened really fast. I mean, the iPhone has only been out, 10 years? And so we did the best we could at the time and made the decision, but now as new data is coming available, now that we've had schools and students who are using these devices for 5 years, we need to go with what the science is saying, and we have better information now. And I do a lot of speaking engagements all over, and a lot of parents have come up to me afterwards, and they're just irate. Because they're like, well, what school do you go to? And I go, well, we actually go to a school that does not allow devices. Well, why do we have to have devices? Because we go to a public school. What can we do? And I say, talk to your principal, talk to your school board, talk to your legislators. I mean, when they rolled them out, it was the best intention. And then the other thing is that a lot of schools say, you know what? We agree with all this data, and we're going to do the research, and we're going to actually look at how much we're actually using them in our classroom and see of the 8 hours that kids are in school, how can we scale that back to the two-hour limit, which is where they're seeing the cognitive decline. And so a lot of schools are looking at still using the Chromebooks but not exceeding the two-hour limit. And why we want to start with the younger children is let's just start there. It's just an easier policy because we really only have a few big school districts using them right now for the younger children.
Thank you. So Representative Heinzman, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last follow-up for Judy. You're talking about the data that supports our concern that screen time could be detrimental or is. Recently, when my own school district was looking at this, I could have swore that they were citing data relative to test scores and other areas that could show potential for improvement if this technology was brought to each individual student in the categories they were discussing. Are they just getting bad information, or am I dreaming when I think that I heard those kinds of conversations happening?
Ms. Stoffel, perhaps.
Mr. Chairman and member legislator, thank you. I don't have that data. I mean, I've looked at the test scores for the state of Minnesota versus the national averages, and let's just take the ACT. My son just took the ACT exam, so I'm well familiar with that. And test scores, the national averages remained about flat the last 5 years, but Minnesota's gone from an average of 23 down to 20.8. And we all know what's going on with the standardized test for K through 8, you know, that we're having in the 50 percentages of people that are passing the math and reading.
Thank you. Representative Katiza-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrison, thanks for bringing forward this bill. I think this is really important information that we all take time to consider and as we're moving forward with additional data and as research continues to come out. I have a quick clarification, though. In line 1.10, where it says, without engagement from a teacher or other students, I'm hoping that one of you can shed a little bit of light on what that means. Is that one-on-one attention? Is that small group? I think that if a teacher is presenting to a class and the kids are kind of navigating and touching the screen with an individual device on their own. Is that classified as engagement? I just want to make sure that we have a little bit better view on what that looks like.
So Representative Morrison or Ms. Stoffel, I'm not sure who wants to respond to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Okay. We're saying one-to-one in accordance with the Academy of Pediatrics guidelines, and so we need an adult to kind of explain and walk them through that. If it's a small group where the teacher is doing it on an iPad, you know, that may be different. You know, the smart book thing in front of the class is different because that now we're approaching more like a television. So a lot of the data shows why we're getting basically digital dementia in some of these MRIs is because of the closeness to our eyes. We have these like Paleolithic brains, right? And we're not made to look at something like this all day long, moving very, very fast and with all the different colors and lights, which is why the TV like 20 feet away we're much more comfortable with. So. Thank you for your question.
Representative Cadiza, would you follow up?
Yes, just a quick follow-up. So I just want to make sure that if we move forward with this, that we maybe want to consider an amendment, Representative Morrison, that would put a little bit more of a parameter if it is going to be a small group or one-on-one guideline.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cadiza Watuna. That's not a bad idea. We'll consider that. Thank you. And I also just wanted to add to Representative Heinzman, not having the studies that were referenced at your school board, I hesitate to comment, but I'm guessing that they were not based on studies of very young children.
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrison, are we going to do the amendment?
So I was kind of, Representative Morrison, is this now the time to do that? We'll need to do it before the end.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you. I know this is a little unorthodox, Representative West, but we wanted to present the whole bill and then present the amendment, and I can explain after we do.
Yeah, okay. So perhaps, so why don't we do that now then? So Representative Morrison, you move the A1 amendment, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, I would like to move the A1 amendment.
And maybe, Representative Morrison, you can just describe what this does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The A1 amendment would delete the PSA portion of the bill, as well as the including, it would exclude kindergarten. Given the constraints of a non-budget year, we really want to make sure that we're able to move forward with making this just a policy bill to limit preschoolers' use of screens, and then hopefully come back next year during a budget year to expand a PSA and include kindergartners.
Okay. Okay. So then all in favor of approval of the A1 amendment to the bill in which – oh, pardon me. Representative
–
oh, okay. Representative Franson, please. Or – okay. So all in favor of approval of the A1 amendment to put the bill in which the author – the form in which she wishes. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Aye. So then it's the bill is in the form the author wishes. And then, so Representative West, that cover you? Or you had something else, Representative
something
West?
Else. So you
do. Okay, please, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Morrison. I completely agree with the sentiment of the bill. All the data does point to screen time being harmful, especially in anxiety and depression increases in teenagers, like you mentioned earlier. I'm concerned with its... a very short, now that we've deleted most of it, which is one of the reasons why I asked, it's a very broad bill with very few words, and there's a lot of different exceptions that we should be considering with special needs kids and other issues like that where they need technology in order to do things. I don't have any specific recommendations, but I think going forward we should make sure we have exceptions in the statute. Because you never know how something like short and sweet is not necessarily short and sweet when it comes to statute.
Thoughts, Representative Morrison?
Mr. Chair, Representative West, I guess I would, I'm not sure what those exceptions might be, and I think that children with disabilities also deserve one-on-one attention with a teacher.
Okay. Representative Damathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrison, thank you for bringing this forward. I appreciate the details from the testifiers also and the research. As a mom of four and grandma of almost four, this matters, and I've watched that change over time. One question looking at the bill,
knowing that this is for publicly funded preschool. My question is, how would that include, and if it does include, family child care centers that are receiving CCAP or other early learning scholarships? Does that apply to these programs also?
Thoughts on that, Representative Morrison, or your testifiers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Damuth, I believe that it should, because those are also publicly funded.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative, okay. And Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have to be upfront about this bill. I'm struggling with this one. While I certainly agree 100% that we should limit screen time, and I know that we do that with my nieces and nephews, and generally when we do allow them screen time, it is actually usually working on educational programs with the child, things that help them learn their letters and words and, you know, school, those kinds of things. In fact, that is the only type of programming I will participate in with the kiddos. I do not allow them to watch YouTube videos. I do not allow them to do anything else unless it is with me and specifically educational in nature. But certainly I understand and appreciate the idea of limiting screen time, and I know we do that in our own family. In fact, usually you have maybe 10 minutes before dinner, and then it is cut off. You must put all devices away. It is time to have family time, and so forth. So I agree with that premise of the bill. I even appreciate the idea of trying to set some limits. But I have to be upfront. The one piece that I'm really concerned about is, and I realize this is a non-budget year, but in all fairness, I actually feel like the part that we've stricken from the bill based on the amendment is actually the more important part of this bill. In fact, I think it's the key part of this bill, because not having that educational component to talk to teachers, to talk to individuals, to talk to parents, it feels like that is not going to be the most effective without having that education component. And so I will be upfront in saying that I have serious reservations about this bill without the education component.
Anything that you want? That may have been more of a comment, but if Representative Morrison, if you do want to say something, you can. Otherwise, I'll move to another testifier.
Mr. Chair, I would just say thank you, Representative, for your comments and your support. And for that very reason, we will be returning next year to ask for the funding to enact a PSA.
Thank you. Ms. Venable, you're going to say something briefly if you can.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, I thank you for your concerns, and we, of course, agree with you, and that's why we came to our representative, our senator, about this. And we just want to get the conversation going, and we feel like even if we were to do this limit on the iPads in the preschools, that would actually get the conversation going with the school districts especially. We're starting to talk to our school districts about this and the tech people, because a lot of the tech people are the ones, you know, it's just sort of a, what's happening? Everyone's just kind of doing it. No one's really talking about it. We just want to raise awareness, and yet we're going to go for this campaign. If we have to go to the private sector, if we have to go to Bill Gates Foundation, we're going to do this. In fact, we just got an estimate for some posters. We could print 10,000 posters for only $2,000 and get them out to all the ECFE programs in the state, so we could start just a simple campaign. So anything you can do to support us, we really appreciate it.
So we got a couple more questions, and I do want to wrap up in the next couple of minutes because we do have another bill we need to get to. We've got Representative Damuth, we'll go back to, and then Representative Wozlik, and then probably need to be done. Or Representative, and then Representative Franson, but then we'll need to be done. Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We talked briefly about the special ed students that might be affected by this. And Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, we do have a couple of parents that testified earlier in the room. Is it possible to just hear a little input without completely putting them on the spot, but how that may affect them?
If you have a question about how this would affect somebody and we can get expertise in the room, I'm fine with that. Yeah, if we can if the parent is willing to do so. Again, I want to keep things focused, but you're looking for expertise, and if we have some in the room and you're willing to share, then please come on up. If one of the parents, I see some nodding from the parents.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. I think this is Ms. Christensen, if I remember. Yeah, so please just remind us who you are if you can, and then if you can please answer Representative Damon's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Maren Christensen Hofer. To answer your question about how this might affect children with special needs, I have to admit I'm feeling a little nervous over there, so I really appreciate the opportunity to speak. Particularly for your children that are non-speaking or use extra communication tools, taking away their devices is like putting tape over their mouth. And that really scares me when we talk about limiting it in the classroom. A lot of children use devices not only for their communication, but also sometimes for their emotional regulation. So again, you know, if a kid is having a hard time in a classroom, taking that away from him really would make things, would elevate a difficult situation rather than make a child more calm. So I would really appreciate it if we could look at some exceptions to that.
Okay, thank you. Good. I think that may need to be what need to be at Representative Namath. Any quick follow-up? I feel like we may have gotten a good answer to your question, if that's okay. We could have Ms. Holden speak, but I kind of want to keep, I think you may have gotten a pretty good, looks like she's agreeing with Ms. Christensen, it sounds like.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. From what I'm hearing, though, is that if we are looking, Representative Morrison, at maybe some exceptions there, I think that's really important to have feedback on all areas. As much as I like the direction, I don't want to see us miss potential opportunities for all students. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Namath. And Representative Boswick's taking herself off the list. So, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm thinking that there's been some great conversation, brought up some questions. Also, I think that we should maybe send this bill to education policy to look at expanding. If it's good enough for pre-K, then I think kindergarten through sixth grade, it should be also looked at. I also don't think the bill goes far enough. As a mother with two children in middle school, I hate the electronic devices, absolutely. I digress. But if we could just bring it to education policy so we can get their viewpoint on the bill as well, I feel a lot better about it.
Thank you, Representative Franson. So I feel like we sort of judge jurisdiction based on what's in the content of the bill at the time, right? So this bill at this point is now pre-kindergarten, and so that's our jurisdiction. If it were amended to include those older grades, then it certainly would go to education policy. But the way that our jurisdiction works is if it's under kindergarten, it is within our jurisdiction. But Representative Franson.
All right, well, technically ECFE does fall under the education policy.
So, Representative Franson, I'm not actually sure that that's true. That's gotten a little bit confusing with the ECFE, but in any case, this is pre-kindergarten, so I'm not sure that ECFE is affected by this anyway. Maybe I'm misunderstanding your question.
Well, okay, but at any rate, I just think that this should probably go to education finance. Representative Muth did bring up some good points, and if this conversation is going to continue next year with funding. Although, if you really wanted funding, we could take some money from House File 1.
Mm.
I mean, that's okay.
Thank you for the suggestion. So, what I'd say is if there's spending, then it would go to education finance. If it was older children, then it would go to education policy. Because at this point, it's neither spending nor older children. It's just within our jurisdiction. Having said that, though, what I think I'm inclined to do at this point is, because there will be a chance to get back this, the issues is to lay it over and continue this discussion. I want to make sure we get to the next bill. And so what I'm going to do, Representative Morrison, what I'm inclined to do is to do that. And when we bring it back up, there won't be further testimonies. We've had that, but just to make sure we can address some of these issues that have been brought up and continue the conversation. And so I think I'm inclined to do that, but I want to thank you, Representative Morrison, of course, and to your testifiers for this really powerful idea and important.
Thank you very much for listening.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for your suggestions.
Thank you so much. And please continue to be in touch with Representative Morrison about that. So with that, House File 3504, as amended, is laid over, and we will get back to that. And so, Representative Neuer, you are up. And we have House File 3672 next on the agenda. And with that, so we can have, so there was, one moment, please. Okay, so if I could have a motion to have House File 3672 be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance.
So moved.
Okay, Representative Pryor moves that. And so House File 3672 is before the committee. Representative Noor, if you can please present your bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3672 addresses the waiting list for basic sliding fee. For many families, lack of childcare is a huge barrier to employment and getting out of poverty or even ending to generational poverty. As you all know, a childcare program is a two-generation program that supports the mother and the child. So this issue of waiting list on basic sliding fee impacts many families. For many employers, the lack of childcare creates obstacles to matching their jobs with people who need employment. The basic sliding fee program provides an opportunity to address this barrier, yet at any given time, more than a quarter of the Minnesota counties have to put families on the waiting list for the childcare program. So, Mr. Chair and members, this issue impacts whether you're a big county or small county. You have a letter from letter of support from Wilkin County Human Service Director in your packet. I also have Melissa Hewitt, who's the Human Service Administrator from Stearns County, with me to testify on this bill. Mr. Chair and members, this bill addresses a gap that exists when it comes to addressing the priority for basic sliding fee from the policy perspective.
Thank you, Representative Noor. We'll move to your testifier in that case. So, Ms. Huberty, if you can identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Huberty. I am the Stearns County Human Services Administrator, and I'm here representing the Association of Minnesota Counties, as well as the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 3672 to modify the priorities of families who receive child care assistance. This change will allow us to engage in program simplification and helps us utilize child care funds for those that are most in need. Under current guidelines, the top priority groups to receive child care funding through the basic sliding fee program are students and those working to get off the Minnesota Family Investment Program, which is the MFIP program. But being on MFIP means that you're already automatically eligible for child care assistance. But when you're moving off off MFIP and still require some child care assistance, you are forced from the MFIP funding stream to the basic sliding fee funding stream and become a top priority group in the other funding stream. And then those families that move over actually take up the limited spots for the other families that are in the priority groups in the basic sliding fee categories. And most of those are very often our veterans and those who are currently working or looking for work. We know that when people can't pay for child care, we know what happens with those families. They're frequently forced to quit their jobs, and then they move further into the public assistance system and require a lot more services. So they'll require not only food support, rental assistance, work supports, but they'll need to complete a significant amount of paperwork for that. So we want to encourage people already achieving self-sufficiency in both of the funding streams to sustain the goals they have for economic success. This language change aligns all of our high priority groups with the appropriate funding streams so that more families can obtain child care assistance and ultimately exit the public assistance system. And that's what we're trying to do as counties, trying to get families so that they can get their child care assistance so that they're working and so they ultimately exit towards self-sufficiency. Furthermore, this language allows counties to be more strategic in managing the basic sliding fee funds so that more families receive assistance and can ultimately reach their economic goals. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you so much. Let's first ask if there's anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill. So not seeing anyone in the audience, then I think I maybe saw the Representative Heintzman may have something, but I'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah, Representative Heintzman, no problem.
I just heard the testifier talk about the high priority groups targeted in the bill. I'm trying to figure out who those people are and I guess who is specifically benefiting from this bill being passed, if it were to be passed.
Ms. Huberty.
Chair Pinto, representatives of the committee, all families who are working, but they're the families that are the working poor, essentially. They're employed, but they're barely above it. So what they need actually to stay in the work environment is child care assistance. They're those families who actually mostly only require child care assistance. But if they don't get that, what happens is they go off. They have to quit their jobs, and they go deeper into the public assistance system. The priority groups currently, what this helps us do is take the families currently in the language. It requires MFIP families who are actually doing all the right things. They need a transition year. And during that transition year, they are allowed to get child care assistance, but they have to, behind the scenes, move from the MFIP funding stream over to basic sliding fee. And then when they move over to the basic sliding fee category, they take up all the top spots. So we can't actually help the veterans and a lot of other people that are the working poor but or trying to seek employment. So it's all of the people doing all the right things, the families doing the right things, who just need child care assistance.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knorr, is there a fiscal note here on this bill?
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair and members, this does not address any additional cost to the program. We're only changing the priority how it's designed when you're getting off from MFIP to the DWP being put at the high priority. In fact, this is blocking from other individuals from getting the basic sliding fee because you have to wait for that space to be vacated by or projection that somebody who is getting off from MFIP or DWP will be coming in. This will put them in the same priority but not at the highest priority so that there's no blocking of a space for the MFIP and DWP in this category.
This is maybe just worth pausing for just a second. That I think that there is a cost to the bill, the cost to be in the HHS finance jurisdiction and MFIP. We'll have Mr. Berg explain. And so in a way, this kind of goes back to Representative Franson's question before about the jurisdiction, that in a way we're sort of a policy committee when it comes to this, that we're reviewing the child care connection with this, but the cost to be borne in HHS finance. Maybe Mr. Berg, if you can just explain kind of where we're at with the fiscal note aspect. And then Representative Heitzman, then I'll get back to you.
Mr. Chair, you're exactly correct. First, there is a pending fiscal note request on this. It's not completed yet. Secondly, you're exactly correct that this does not change the cost of the basic sliding fee child care program, which is a fixed appropriation. It just shuffles what order people are eligible for the existing appropriation. However, this bill was fiscal noted, or this idea was fiscal noted in 2017.
Right.
As people are moved to the bottom of the priority list who are currently the ones that are off MFIP DWP in the transition year, the counties will have some discretion to keep those people on transition year extended if they can't get other child care. And so in the 2017 bill, it did show costs in the MFIP program. So it doesn't change anything that's in this committee's jurisdiction except the priority, but then it will create a cost in the HHS Finance Committee.
Which is where it's being sent, and then they'll review the fiscal aspect of it. Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more a question for you. So we passed House File 1 out earlier this session. I'm just wanting to confirm or understand maybe a little bit better. If we fully fund BSF through House File 1, why are we here talking about this particular bill? Is there just,
So, Representative Heitzman, what this bill does, my understanding, is that it allows funding, allows waiting list funding to go further. And it's true that in the shorter term, House File 1 removes the waiting list, but then once you get beyond that, you've still got the issue of, as I understand it from the counties, that they take people off the waiting list, but that just means they get funded from basic sliding fee rather than MFIP, and we haven't actually increased the number of families receiving care. So this is sort of more a longer-term policy change. So House File 1 was funding the next, is putting funding towards the waiting list, and as was discussed quite a bit, it's not ongoing funding. This is a policy change that would be ongoing to change the prioritization order so we can actually, when you take families off the waiting list, you actually expand the number of families receiving care rather than simply shifting them from one funding stream to another. I'm not sure if that's helpful, but
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. I think to some extent that makes sense, but there's still obviously a lot of questions, so appreciate that explanation.
No problem. Thank you. Representative Wozlewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not exactly clear on how these programs interface. MFIP and BSF and child care assistance and that sort of thing. So I'm just clarity around it. If an MFIP family, is it that they no longer qualify for MFIP, that they're moved off and then they have nothing, or is there a continuation? I guess that's kind of the clarifying question around these families are already vulnerable families and just kind of understanding what that means for these families once they're off of that program.
Ms. Huberty.
Chair Pinto, representatives of the committee, what happens is that when families on MFIP are doing all the right things, they get employed and they're kind of finally getting out of poverty. And then they no longer meet the criteria for most of those other MFIP programs. Instead of just dropping them off the cliff and saying, okay, you get nothing now, and then they, of course, go out on their own, and they can't afford, as we know, that child care is extremely expensive. They can't afford it, so they have to drop out of the workforce, and they go right back into the cycle again. So this helps to align that so that we don't have to force. All they're needing is child care assistance. Keep them on MFIP to just get the child care assistance so we don't have to switch them automatically over to the basic sliding fee and take up the slots on the veterans and the other people that are employed or trying to get back in the workforce.
Okay. And Ms. Huberty, can you remind us, I forget if you'd said this before, but the support, like, so is Association of Minnesota Counties, I believe, is supportive. Can you just talk about, we've got Wilkin County, and you're from Stearns, of course. I know this is brought by Hennepin, but kind of who's supportive of this? Ms. Huberty?
Sure. Chair Pinto, representatives of the committee, I'm here on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, as well as the Minnesota Association of Social Services Administrators, so MACSA and AMC, and all counties, as far as I'm aware of, they're in favor of this for exactly this reason. We know what happens. If you don't pay for child care one way or another with these families, they go deeper into the public assistance system, and we all pay more as taxpayers on the other side. They're deeper in, unemployed, paying for it, and 6 to 10 other ways that you may not see in this bill, but we see it every day in the county system.
Right. Okay. Other questions that folks have regarding House File 3672 or any discussion? And I'm not seeing any. So Representative Knorr, any final comments that you have?
Mr. Chair and members, appreciate your support. And I think as we have heard about the barriers that exist for different categories in changing the priority for the basic sliding fee, and I hope I'll get your support to move the bill to the HHS finance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pryor, you have, renewing your motion that House File 3672 be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Division. All in favor of approval of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, House File 3672 is approved. It's on its way to HHS Finance. Representative Knorr, thank you for being here. Ms. Huberty, thank you for coming from Stearns County. So members, we're back on Thursday. A timing note that will be starting at 8:30 on Thursday, so you can get your night owl a little bit on to not have to be here quite as early. And we've got a couple bills up then. So members, thank you so much. And with that, we are adjourned.